So there was a great rabbinic luminary, one of the greatest, arguably, if not the greatest, Torah personality of the 19th century. His name was Rav Moshe Sofer. He was known by the name of his svarim, the Chassam Sofer. And apparently, the legend has it that the Chassam Sofer, in his library, he kept two books separate from each other on the shelf. One book was known as the Krasi Uplasi, a commentary on the Yoredeya, section of Shulchan Aruch that deals with Isser Veheter, Kosher, Mitzvos. And another book, separate on the bookshelf, was the Sefer called Mor Uktzia, which is a commentary on Orach Chaim on the Tur. He kept them separately, the Krasi Uplasi and the Mor Uktzia. And one day, legend has it, he noticed that somehow these two volumes, the Krasi Uplasi and the Mor Uktzia, found themselves situated next to each other on the shelf. And he observed to himself, maybe at this time, the authors of the Krasi Uplasi and the Mor Uktzia, maybe by now they made peace. The controversy that we're going to talk about today, I actually have a lot of feelings about this controversy. Two in particular. I have a feeling, and I've had, in thinking about this and preparing for this, a feeling of nervousness and also a feeling of sadness. A feeling of nervousness, number one, because the amount of scholarship that has been poured into this controversy over the past 200 years would take multiple lifetimes for any one person to study. So it's dangerous to talk about a topic about which so much has been written. But also because when you talk about a topic, a controversy that involves two great Torah scholars, you have to be extremely nervous. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that you have to be wary of the kavod of Talmud Chacham. A person doesn't want to low lane, or the Mishnah uses some very strong language about being incinerated, being burnt or bitten when you start up with the kavod of a Talmud Chacham. So we have to be very careful. So it makes me nervous. And the other is really a profound feeling of sadness, because this controversy, which on the title page and the little source packet we have for this, I'm entitling it The Controversy. This is probably the greatest rabbinic controversy in the last, personal rabbinic controversy in the last, 800 years, 900 years. Not only was it a controversy between two figures, it was actually a controversy with the involvement of almost every significant rabbinic personality, every gaon that lived at the first half of the 18th century. It's a controversy that never seems to have died. And it's very sad. It's very sad because the damage of this controversy, the chilul Hashem, the kavod of Torah, which was diminished. Look, it's a sad feeling. It's a sad feeling. I don't think, at least I'm not the kind of person who's like, gets up in the morning and gets excited about people tearing each other down. And so there's a feeling of sadness that comes along with this controversy, because it runs deep and it continues. You would not even believe that this debate over this issue, it was not even settled even several years ago. There were still people writing about it, trying to defend one side and the other. And it is unresolved. It is simply unresolved. Let's begin with the end. Another legend. You see two pictures here in source number one, page number one. These pictures are of gravestones, matzevas. The left side is the matzeva. It says the matzeva of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabban. It goes on and on about the great Reb Yonason Eibeshitz. And on the right side, also a very lengthy matzeva, gravestone, inscription, dedicated to the late Rabbi Yaakov Emden. These two gravestones are situated right next to each other on the page because they are five graves apart from each other in the cemetery in Altona. And the legend goes that that burial ended that way because of the notable Yehuda, who we're going to come back to much later in much greater detail, Rav Yecheskel Landau of Prague. The notable Yehuda who happened to be in Altona at the time of the passing of Rav Yaakov Emden in 1796. And apparently, when the Chevra Kadisha was present at the passing of Rav Yaakov Emden, they heard him say, as his neshama was leaving, Shalom Alecha Abba Mori, greetings to you, my father. Who was the father of Rav Yaakov Emden? None other than the Heliga, the great Gaon Adir, known as the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Ashkenazi, the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, also the triple communities, we'll get back to in a little bit. His father was the Chacham Tzvi. So his neshama, we know we have a tradition from the Gemara that when a person's neshama goes to the other world, they're greeted by neshamas from that world. So he was greeting his father, Shalom Alecha Abba Mori. And then the last words that he said were Shalom Alecha Rabbi Yonason. Greetings to you, Rabbi Yonason. And with that, his parcha nishmasa, his neshama left the world. And in searching for a place to bury him, they couldn't find. They found one suitable grave, five graves away from Rav Yonason Eibeshitz. They came to the Notabi Yehuda, who was in Altona at that time, and the Notabi Yehuda said, based on that story, they must have made peace at the end. So we should bury Rav Yaakov Emden five graves from the man. You can't even use the descriptors that Rabbi Yaakov Emden used against Rabbi Yonason Eibeshitz. You cannot say them in a shul. But the end, according to the legend, is that not only did their books lie next to each other in the Chasam Sofer's library, but they themselves, their eternal rest, is literally in the same cemetery, five graves away from each other in Altona. So that is the end. What do we take away from this story? That even though these two men were the most bitter of rivals, literally sonim mamish, absolute arch enemies of each other in their lifetime for a milchamas Hashem, for what they believed was the absolute necessity. And that, you know, that idea that they're buried next to each other is a nice idea, but it's a legend. They couldn't find another grave, so they buried him there. But for us, the end, you know, I want to begin with the end, actually, today, is that if you open up a Mishneh Brura, edited by the Chafetz Chaim, in the laws of Orach Chaim, you will find citations from the Moruk Tzia, from Rav Yaakov Emden. And if you open up any contemporary Halacha Sefer in Yoredea, you will find citations for the Kreis Uplasi. And that somehow the Jewish people, we have managed to accept the Torah teachings of both of these rabbinic figures. And somehow this controversy has not been settled. Their arguments have not been settled. But we have found a way to learn from both of them. And that's the end of the story. That they're both buried. They both left Torah, printed Torah legacies, whether it's the Urim V'Tumim, which is the commentary on the Choshen Mishpat from Yonashan Eibeshitz, or the She'elas Yavis, the Tshuvas of Rav Yaakov Emden. Both of these are quoted, and both of these are important. Both of these are going to play a role in our observance. Today, Lamaisa, in your kitchen, in your daily observance, these are going to be called upon. These are going to be both part of our Torah existence, our Torah life. So that's the end of the story. That's the end of the story. Should we start at the beginning? Okay. There are probably several contemporary scholars who can tell us this story. The greatest, the best, unquestionably, the most outstanding expert on this issue lives in a modest home filled with thousands and thousands of svarim. My teacher, the gaon, the scholar, and the huge anav, the simple, humble man, Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman, Shlita. Schneer is probably the world's expert on the Emden Eibishitz controversy. His picture, because he's just the best, his picture is pictured right here in the middle of your source packet. I did send him an email last night letting him know that I am delivering this talk this morning at the risk of speaking about something about which I know, compared to him, nothing. But he sent me back an email wishing me hatzlacha, so I'm sure this year is going to be perfect. No problems. He's hands down, I would say, known as the world's expert on this topic. He has a website. It's called LymanLibrary.com. I gave you a little picture of the page on the website. You can go to the website. You can get almost all of his printed articles. There are over 100-some articles, and I think a half a dozen of them are on issues related to the Emden Eibishitz controversy. I read most of them in preparation for today. They are amazing, and he's amazing. So that's the first place to look. There is another scholar. I don't know as much about him, but I read one of his articles. His name is Pavel. I think it's pronounced Mashenko. He's a history professor in Johns Hopkins who has written about this, as well as Rabbi Pinny Dunner has done some research published about this as well. But Schneer is your man. He has a talk on YU Torah, which is better than anything you're going to hear from me. But Lamaisa, we cannot talk about controversies and not talk about this controversy. So Schneer takes us through this from multiple different angles, and we're going to try to just synthesize it in a short period of time for today. The beginning of this controversy, the origins of this controversy, date back to the 17th century. If you look on the next page in your timeline, in 1648, there was a man who declared himself the Messiah, the Mashiach. This wrought tremendous, tremendous upheaval in the Jewish world. That year, 1648, may be known to you for another upheaval that took place. Shabbosai Tzvi is running around the Middle East, Turkey, and then Gaza, Yerushalayim, other places. But what's happening in Europe at that time? Anybody remember? 1648? How would you remember? 1648, 1649, Khmelnytsky. It's a very, very difficult time in Jewish history. The Khmelnytsky massacres that are ravaging Eastern Europe, let's say all the way from Lithuania, from Vilna, down, of course, through Ukraine, Poland, devastating Jewish communities. Terrible, terrible time for Jews. 1648, Shabbosai Tzvi, he has a gabbai, his name's Nathan of Gaza, and they start running around proclaiming that he is the Messiah. If you see back on the first page on the left-hand side, this is the copy of a front page plate from a book enthroning Shabbosai Tzvi as the Messiah. This creates a huge tumult all across the world. The world reaches Europe. Ad kedei kach, that there were even many rabbis, some of them significant rabbis. Maybe the most notable was Reb Chaim Benaviste. Reb Chaim Benaviste was the author of a commentary on the Torah called the Knesset HaGedola, which we use to this day. It's quoted in the Mishnah Berurah all the time. He thought that Shabbosai Tzvi was the Mashiach. Shabbosai Tzvi said, Mashiach has arrived. Shabbosai Tzvi was learned in studied Kabbalah, purported to know certain Kabbalistic secrets, and he was engaged in all kinds of crazy behaviors, like eating pork and saying a bracha, Matir Isurim, because the time of the Mashiach has come, and licentious behavior, all kinds of crazy things. Until, in 1666, he is picked up by the Turkish government, by the Sultan, and he's told, you know, you have a couple of choices. One of them is either convert, the other one is to die. And so he says, yeah, I'll convert. So he converts to Islam. And he dies in 1676.
How old was he in 1676?
He was a young man. I think he was in his early 30s, maybe late 20s. I think he was born in the 1620s. So Shabsai Tzvi creates a worldwide spiritual crisis. Even though Shabsai Tzvi converts to Islam and dies in 1676, and people like Reb Chaim Benaviste, they go into a self-imposed tshuva process, doing penance for even thinking at one time that Shabsai Tzvi was the Mashiach. But that canard never died. People still thought there were sects all across Europe, secret groups who thought that Shabsai Tzvi was the Mashiach. And this was like an undercurrent that existed into the 18th century. It became like a flare-up in different places. So there was, for example, in 1713, in Amsterdam, there was a guy by the name of Nehemia Chayun, who was proselytizing. He was out teaching the messianic teachings of Shabsai Tzvi. And he became outed and put into Cheirim, excommunicated by the Chacham Tzvi, but it became a huge brouhaha to the point where later the Chacham Tzvi ended up having to leave Amsterdam because of a big machlokas. But it was simmering. In 1724, there was a Polish guy, Reb Moshe, whatever. He came from Poland. He was traveling through Germany. He got stopped. They opened up his bag. They found all kinds of strange documents in there, including an anonymously written work called Va'ovo Hayom El Ha'ayin, which, based on a pasuk in Sefer Bereishis, is a very bizarre, Kabbalistic, and highly sexually explicit document, which it propounds many of Shabsai Tzvi's interpretations of Kabbalah. Kabbalah, let's just take a step back to understand what is Kabbalah. Kabbalah, the word literally means, Kabbalah means to receive. It's from the Torah HaNistar, the hidden teachings. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu was given the Torah at Har Sinai, he was given Torah HaNigla, the revealed Torah, but he was also given Torah HaNistar, the hidden Torah. Imagine you went to Walgreens and you went to pick up a prescription. So there are two dimensions of the prescription, right? One is my doctor would have to prescribe for me which medication. So I go to the pharmacist and I say, I need this and this medication. I need to find out from my doctor, how many times a day do I take this? How many milligrams of this medication do I take? You have a prescription, right? It tells you which medicine is appropriate for which thing so that you can deal with this medical issue. But that's not the only story of this medication. In a pharmacy lab somewhere in Delaware or South Jersey, I remember seeing signs for AstraZeneca when we drive up and down the turnpike. In a lab somewhere, there's some guy probably wearing a coat with a microscope and white powder and all kinds of ingredients. And he's sitting there formulating this medication. And so that chemist who's in the lab somewhere, he's not thinking about a patient. He's thinking about what are the ingredients and how do you formulate it and how do you make sure that it binds together and what do the chemical interactions create in terms of side effects and all those different kinds of things. So Torah HaNigla is the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to interact. The revealed Torah is the way we interact with the world. So we put on tefillin. We light Shabbos candles. We sit in a sukkah. That's the prescription. The Torah HaNigla is the prescription of how you live. You open up the Shulchan Aruch, you say, this is the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to live as spiritual beings in the world. Torah HaNistar says, let's go behind the scenes, back to the lab, and try to understand, well, how did God create the world? What was the recipe that went into the mitzvah of tefillin, how it connects to the ultimate Ein Sof of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So for most people, when you take Advil, you don't really care what's in the Advil. You just know the doctor says you take the Advil, and in your experience, intuitively, you have experienced that Advil has helped your headache. Shine, that's the end of the story. Or Tylenol, I'm not endorsing any particular product here. But maybe there's somebody out there who has a particular interest in understanding what's in the Advil. The challenge with this is that could be very dangerous, because somebody who is not a trained chemist, who has not had extensive and long-standing shimush or apprenticeship, if that person were to start breaking open the pills in the pharmacy in the back and start mixing things together to accomplish what they thought would be important, that could be deadly. So people who are studying Kabbalah, who do not have the appropriate shimush Yerushalayim knowledge of Torah in general, they could create compounds that are very dangerous. So Shabtai Tzvi and other people, they're studying Kabbalah, they're opening these works, and they're writing works, and you come up with something like Va'ovo Hayom Ela'ayin, and it creates a huge stir. Let's fast forward a couple of years, and then we're going to come back. The bottom left on your page is this front plate from Shabtai Tzvi. That's the shoresh. That's the source of this controversy between Rav Yaakov Emden and Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz. But the controversy comes to a head over the picture on the bottom right of your screen, of your page, and that is this picture. It looks like a Jewish star with Hebrew letters in it. That is called a kameya, an amulet. This kameya surfaces, and people are looking at this amulet, among others, and they're saying this is very peculiar. Not the amulet per se being peculiar that people are using amulets, because already from the times of the Gemara, it was known, the Gemara discusses, and the Meiri points out that this is not a violation of necromancy or of sorcery, that if you have an amulet that works, the Gemara says that's called a kameya that's muchzak. People would write incantations or letters of shemos that relate to Torah Sanistar, and they would write them on parchment, and people would hold on to them. These amulets that you're looking at, the example of one here, was given in approximately the year 1750. Several of them were given to women who were having childbirth issues. They started to circulate, and it turns out that there are undeniable references, according to one way of reading them. This is not necessarily, again, it's clear, I'm making it very clear, one way of reading them is undeniably a reference to Shabtai Tzvi. Now, whether or not that is a coincidence, whether it's an accident, whether that happens to be, or that was the intention, is the subject of a huge controversy. But this is what kicks off the ultimate controversy. Who wrote that book, Va'avo Ha'ayom Hel Ha'ayin? We don't know, but there was some concern about who may have written that book, and who wrote this kameya. We cannot say with certainty, but we have a very high degree of suspicion. Who are the two players in this controversy? Turn to the next page. Let's go back to page 2, and let's talk about the two players. The concern of who may have written Va'avo Hayom El Ha'ayin, although it's certainly unproven, may have been the same person who acknowledged writing at least one and maybe more of these kameyas, these amulets, none other than, by the time he passes away in 1794, I'm sorry, that's a mistake, 1764. You got to fix that on the page. It's 1764, which is very important. 1764, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz. I'm going to fix it right now. He died in the middle of the controversy. Here we go, 1764. Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, who was maybe the foremost rabbinic authority, maybe at least one of the foremost rabbinic authorities of his time. He was born in Krakow, and in about 1700, he moved to Eibeshitz, where his father was appointed the rabbi. He was known, recognized as a child prodigy. He married into a distinguished family called the Spira family. and he was a very talented preacher, a lamdan. He moved to Prague, where for 30 years he served there as a dayan, as a rabbi, although not the chief rabbi. He was extremely punctilious in his observance. He was an ascetic, and he was unquestionably a brilliant, genius, virtuoso Torah scholar. Undeniably, a Gadol Hador, hands down, no question. This Kreis Uplasi that we mentioned earlier is the standard, a standard work on Yoredeya. It is an encyclopedic work, and Urim V'Tumim as well. In 1724, he's in Prague, and people start saying, because he had actually crossed paths with that guy from Amsterdam, the Sabbatian, people start saying, well, it sounds a little bit, maybe it's connected to Rav Yaakov, Rav Yonason Eibeshitz. So Rav Yonason Eibeshitz in 1725, and again later in 1751, 1755, and 1761, publicly signed on bans, excommunications, what we call a cherem, against the people in the Shabbosai Tzvi sect. However, he in each of these cases, it was careful to make it known that these people could always do tshuva. Okay. He spends 30 years in Prague from 1711 until 1741. The chief rabbi of Prague at that time was Rav David Oppenheim, the author of the She'ilas, I think it's She'ilas and Tshuvas Nishal David, which is quoted in Rav Ovadia and other tshuvas. But Rav David Oppenheim and Rav Yonason Eibeshitz did not see eye to eye, so he did not succeed him. But he left Prague and he went to Metz. If you look on the map on the top, you see where Prague is in the middle. Metz is way left, so the Metz is in this Alsace-Lorraine region, so it's between France and Germany. So he's going from Prague. You see the center is Prague. Left is Metz. He's going to Metz. That's where he is until he moves to, and you see at the top, this is the key community, 1750, he becomes the chief rabbi of what's known as the triple community. You see at the top, Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek. That's the top of the map. That community, which you see is just at the northern edge of Germany, was actually under the Kingdom of Denmark. It's just on the edge of Poland and Germany and Denmark. He becomes the chief rabbi. Who is opposing him? These amulets become known around then, 1750, 1751. Who is living at that time in Altona? None other than Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden, born in 1697 in Altona. He's born there because at that time the Chacham Tzvi was in Altona. He was a student of his father, the Chacham Tzvi, and then in Amsterdam. He became well known also in his own learning, although, yes, he was mostly self-taught, although he was certainly a prominent Talmud Chacham. If you ask people who are greater than I, who are in the know, people, I think, would say that if you compare the two, Rav Yonason Eibeshitz was a much greater and much more recognized Gaon in the world of Torah learning. But Rav Yaakov Emden was no slouch. He was not just a balabas with a printing press. Rav Yaakov Emden was in Altona. In 1733, he came back to Altona, where he received permission to establish a private shul in his house. So he had a shtiebel, he had a printing press, and he had a small community. He was very sensitive. He was very active in this anti-Sabbatian movement, which was also a controversy that his father was involved in, the Chacham Tzvi. Well, these rumors about Rav Yonason Eibeshitz started at, as we mentioned, already 25 years before, they never seem to go away. They never seem to go away. And in 1750, Rev Yaakov Emden, who has like the most hyper anti-Sabbatian antennae, who can smell it out like a canine at JFK Airport, he gets wind of these Kameas and he gets several copies of them, and he notices the Sabbatian images and the words that are in these Kameas. So on February 4th, 1751, on a Thursday morning in the private shul in his house, he announces that the chief rabbi of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, the Gaon, the Gadol Hador, the chief rabbi who lives around the corner from him, Rev Yonasan Eibeshitz, is a secret Sabbatian, and that he should be defrocked, put in cherem, and thrown out of the community. Now, it is also known, remember, Rev Yonasan Eibeshitz came from Metz to become the chief rabbi of the three communities. Well, who was living in the three communities at that time was passed over, was not the chief rabbi, Rev Yaakov Emden. So there's also some personal element here that you have to be careful of. I will take a step, quick step back before we continue in this story. And this is one of the things that Schneer, should live and be well, he does so brilliantly. And it's important to do when you are studying a case like this. And that is to go back to a principle, a very famous principle in American Jewish jurisprudence called just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. It's very important to look at the facts. We cannot measure, in general, Hevem Masuna Badin, it's not our place to be judging other people, but we cannot take anything other than what we know in front of us. So, for example, if you have a document, you have to know, is it an original document? Just because somebody says it's a forgery doesn't mean that it's a forgery, but just the facts. So you have to look very carefully at the facts. You have to be careful, you have to be cautious, you have to know what you don't know. But these amulets certainly had the potential, they had interpretation as Shabsai Tzvi documents.
Can you give an example?
So, the one that I put on the page, I don't think so. So, here's what I'll tell you to do. If you look in one of those, in the article, the newest edition, not the newest, maybe, in 2006, Schneer published an article with somebody else with an actual copy of the notarized amulets. Because what happened was, one of the Rabbanim who was involved in this controversy knew that it could be an issue, that people would say, oh, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz didn't write that amulet. So they actually had two people from the Metz Jewish community, two prominent people, who notarized the amulets to confirm that they were actually from Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. So in the back there, he actually has the pictures of those amulets. It's called, I think it's called New Evidence and Discovery, the amulets, the actual amulets. So go online, because I didn't put them in the source packet, but you could just see them online in the article. And you see that if you read the letters clockwise, it's based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, which has a messianic reference. And one of them, I think, actually, if it spells out Shabsai somehow, it's like if you, but, so what is, so I'm kind of jumping a little bit ahead, but basically what's happening here is that let's go back now tonight to 1751. Rav Yaakov Emden says, you see, he's a Sabbatian, he's writing amulets, and they have messianic Shabsai Tzvi messages. Rav Yaakov Emden makes this accusation, and he puts Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, the chief rabbi, in cherem. The chief rabbi, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, gets up and he says, you're in cherem, and anybody who davens in your shul is in cherem. So much so that there became a brouhaha in the community. Pinny Dunner tells the story that there was a guy, his name was, let me tell you his name, Moshe Kasowitz. On May 7th, 1751, the chazan in the shul, he walked up to the amud. Could you imagine this in the middle of shul? He walks up to the amud to daven. But as he walks there, three guys in the shul who were supporters of Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz say, excuse me, where are you going to say Shokanad? You're going to daven for the Amid? You're not going anywhere. You are a disgusting person. You are vile, and you can't daven for us. How dare you support the enemy of the chief rabbi of our community? What do? They got into a fist fight. A brawl broke out in the middle of the shul because the supporters of the chazan, Rav Yaakov Emden, started pushing into the amud. And then the supporters of Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz started punching the chazan in the face. He got punched in the mouth. The police were called. This conflict got so out of hand that the unrest created a danger for the life of Rav Yaakov Emden, who had to flee Altona to Amsterdam because he was worried that people were going to kill him. The king of Denmark had a trial set up at which all the evidence was presented, and a very eloquent defender of Yonas and Eibeshitz defended him. So the king says, if Yonas and Eibeshitz is right, he should be the chief rabbi. They come back to Hamburg. Hamburg says, we're an independent city. We don't accept what you have to say. It was crazy. But not only was it true locally, not only was it true on a governmental and a social level, it involved Talmidei Chachamim, the rabbis across Europe. Let's go back to our map. Here you have on your map, where is the epicenter of this machlokes? Up here on the top, in the three communities. Right here. Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek. But in Metz, who was it that preceded Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz as the rabbi? The Pnei Yoshua, Rav Yoshua Falk. Pnei Yoshua had no personal interest. He was at this point a rabbi in Frankfurt. And he published open letters and was open. The Pnei Yoshua was, you could argue, the Zakana Rabbanim, the eldest of the rabbis. The Pnei Yoshua. He insisted that Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz was a Sabbatian. Because of that, he couldn't hold on to his position in Frankfurt because he was agitated by pro-Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz supporters in the Frankfurt Jewish community. Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz gives a drush in Altona. People are so moved. He denies everything. People are crying. In 1755, he publishes a work called Luchos Ha'edus, which is defending himself. But it's not enough. The Vilna Gaon, he sends a letter to the Vilna Gaon at the age. Vilna Gaon was at this time not known as a Gaon. He was just known as a rabbi in Vilna who was somebody. He was 35 years old, and the Vilna Gaon wrote back. He said, look, I have to apologize, Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz. I can't get involved in this. But rabbis all across Europe were now weighing in on this issue. Yeah.
So I have a question. It's a little personal.
Yeah. So at this point, everybody is in Cherem in some way. Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz dies, like we said, in 1764. But the controversy doesn't go away. Rav Yaakov Emden has a printing press in his house, and he is cranking out publications. Some of them he signs, and some of them are anonymous. Probably the most famous one is one called Akitzas Akrav, which I think was initially was anonymous, but was known to be, or later found out to be from, and as well as another one called Nesivas Olam. He's cranking out publications calling Rav Yonas and Eibeshitz, the chief rabbi, the most vile and disgusting names. So the temperature is so hot, everybody is sending letters to other rabbis to get askamas back and forth to a controversy that never seems to die. Even with the death of Rav Yaakov Emden, it doesn't die because later scholars keep going back into this. So where do we land? So I want to land with one place. And this will end today. We're not going to read the whole thing, and we're not even going to read the whole passage that we have from Dr. Lyman. Dr. Lyman has an essay. He has two essays. One is published in Hebrew. You can get them both on the website. One is the full text in Hebrew of what's called Igeres Shlomim, the letter of peace, And this article here, this is the second, this is the English translation of pieces of it. The author of this letter is later going to be known as the great Noda Behuda, which is the author, that's the author's great responsa work, Noda Behuda, Rav Yecheskel Landau, who will later become the chief rabbi of Prague. The Prague community, which was the home of Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, where he actually wanted to come back to live at the end of his life and never did. There's a whole story about that, that he wasn't allowed back in Prague. It's a crazy, crazy story. What does Rav Yecheskel Landau, who at this time is living in Yampol, which if you go back to your map, I'm sorry to keep going back and forth, but it's just good to see, he's in Yampol all the way in Ukraine, sending a letter to say, guys, everybody, please, please, I'm begging you, can we tone it down? Can we find a way out? Igeres Shlomim, a letter of peace. Can we find a way out? On the one hand, he starts by saying, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz is an unquestionable Torah genius. He is a gaon. He is a chacham that we have to respect, whose credentials cannot be challenged. That's number one. On the other hand, he says, the reaction that Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz has to the cheirim of Rav Yaakov Emden is wrong. It's misplaced. Rav Yaakov Emden is doing l'shem shamayim or whatever. He's trying to root out Sabbatians. Maybe there's some personal negiah here or not. And he says, he says, regarding these amulets, look, page 3 here. I will express my opinion. This is Schneer's translation. Second paragraph. A simple reading based on a cursory inspection would lead me to conclude that their author fell into the trap of belief in Shabbosai Tzvi. If not for the presumption of innocence of the Gaon Rabbi Yonasan and the fact that the wise Chacham is Adif Minavi and that a reputable scholar is treated favorably, all of the above relates to suspicion of guilt and the need to investigate the author. But it does not identify the author with certainty as a heretic. Who can judge matters of the heart? And I think this is the important takeaway for us. Says the Noda Behuda, do you know for sure what he was thinking when he wrote this? Do you know for sure who wrote this? Even if it was notarized. Especially when no signatures appear in the amulets themselves. If testimony was taken before the Rabbinic Court of Metz, I question its legality. Do we take testimony when the accused party is not present? This should certainly not be done in life and death cases like ours. How many different hands did the amulets pass through? Etc., etc. Questions. Questions, questions, questions. So go to the next page. Regarding the amulets, I will reveal the truth and not engage in a cover-up. Despite all the praise of the Gaon Rabbi Yonasan, I made every effort to decipher them in a manner that would not lend support to the nonsensical teachings of the Sabbatean fools, but did not succeed. Nonetheless, I do not read them as heretical texts, for the heresy is not explicit. So what do you think he should do? I think we should do the following. I think, he says, that we should put them away. We should send all the amulets back to Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz. We should ask him never to write amulets and to never let these out of his sight and to desist from any activity in this realm. And at the same time, ask him to denounce and to ban, which he did, obviously, as we mentioned before, Shabbosai Tzvinix. And at the same time, ask everyone who is attacking Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz to desist. And that if somebody starts up again and slanders Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, they should be put in cheirim. Basically creating a situation where we can calm down the temperature and we can try to mitigate the Chilul Hashem and the Kavod HaTorah, which is being disgraced in this debate. Because the Crazy Plasy and the Urva Tuma, they're going to remain on the shelf. And that somehow, and this is a point of departure for a much longer, more sophisticated, and more substantive conversation, but somehow he's willing to accept a compromise and to allow the suspicion of the secret Sabbateanism to remain while not completely and totally removing the Svarim and the great Torah scholarship from circulation, to create some kind of space between the chashad, the concern about Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz and his secret Sabbateanism versus his Torah Sanigla, which is an important contribution to the Torah world. What's the postscript? The postscript is that this potential, which could have been an avenue out for Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, who never stood before a Beis Din, he gave a drush about it once, and he wrote a book about it, but he didn't address all the amulets and everything. It was rejected by Rav Yaakov Emden. Because Rav Yaakov Emden said, that's a cop-out. If this man is really a Sabbatian, we have to go after him all the way. He has to be completely defrocked and thrown out of the three communities. And that's where we leave things. Because the question of whether or not Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz was a secret Sabbatian, it is unknown. It is definitely true, Schneer has in another article, so far I think we've referenced six, in a different article, there was a follower of Shabtai Tzvi who crops up in Poland around this time in the 1750s named Jacob Frank, a group called the Frankists. Some of you have heard of them. There's also wild followers of Shabtai Tzvi doing all kinds of avarice and immoral things. So Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz does write a strong letter denouncing them, although it was not known to Rav Yaakov Emden. But the question still remains. And I think the way that Rav Yecheskel Landau wants us to look at this controversy is to say, look, it is possible, we don't know what Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz's secret leanings were in his heart. But at the same time, that Torah scholarship is significant, and therefore it should not be dismissed. Where do we land? The same where we started. That both the Crazy Plasy and the Sheila Siavitz, they're right next to each other on the shelf of the Chasam Sofer. Their graves are right next to each other. And as uncomfortable as it is, we have to tell the story, A, to learn about the dangers and the damage of machlokas, which we've talked about, to remind ourselves to be careful about studying the facts, which is exactly what the Noda Behuda wants us to do, which is not to engage in innuendo. Yes, the claims of Rav Yaakov Emden, many of them were spot on, but Schneer has another article where he points out that one of the arguments that Rav Yaakov Emden writes in one of his books, that even on the tombstone of Elka Eibeshitz, Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz's wife, there was a Shabtai Tzvi reference. So what does Schneer do? He goes to the cemetery and he checks and he sees that Rav Yaakov Emden misrepresents it slightly because he only enlarges certain letters, but not all the letters. Nobody has got all the truth in this story. And so we have to be very careful to only look at the facts, to take anecdotal evidence just as that, as anecdotal evidence. And to be very careful, it comes back to the din of Hevim Mesunim Adin. Do we need to judge other people? If we judge other people, how we judge them? I don't know if this is a fulfilling ending or not. It still leaves me with that sad and unsettled feeling, but that's the parsha. And the fact that we have to engage and understand for what it was, to try to learn from it, that's, I think, maybe one of the main takeaways. So, yashar koach, and I hope you sleep well tonight.